Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio, at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems the good they die young. You know, I just looked around and he's gone. Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems the good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone. Da 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 da. Anybody here seen my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems the good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone. Didn't you love the things that they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? And we'll be free someday soon. It's gonna be one day. Anybody here seen my old friend Bobby? Can you tell me where he's gone? I thought I saw him walking up over the hill with Abraham, Martin, and John. The 60s were a decade of great change, of a whole generation waking up and taking to the streets in demonstrations against war, against discrimination, and for peace, for equal rights. But it was also a decade of great violence against the leaders that we believed in, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. Dion's memorable song spoke to those tragedies, also invoking the death of Abraham Lincoln, whose reign in the White House was shortened in similar fashion. Great change, great leaders, great violence. Must there always be violence in those times? I don't know. We haven't had times like that since. Instead of visionary thinkers embracing change, we've had reactionary plotters resisting it. Our leaders seek not to dream, to build, to empower the oppressed, but rather to control, to destroy, to enable those who suppress the rights of their people on the pretense of bringing them democracy. On this show, we dream of a world where peace is desired rather than war, where love is desired rather than hate. We urge you to dare to dream with us. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. We're here every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on listener-supported Revolution Radio. Please support our network with a donation to keep us and all the other great shows coming to you. And now my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome a special guest, Sherwood Ross, speaking with us from Coral Gables, Ole Damegard in Spain, and Mickey Z in New York City. So tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Coral Gables, somewhere in Spain, New York City, New York, and wherever you are. I'd like to share an email exchange I had this week with an editor of a small daily newspaper in northern Minnesota, Bill Hanna of the Virginia Daily Times. I was thinking that I would like to see if there might be any part-time reporter work I could do around the area, so I sent out email notes to the area papers. And Bill Hanna sent back, "Would you be open at all to a full-time opportunity of reporting and editing?" I said, "Bill, I might be. What do you have? Could we talk about it in person, maybe next Monday or Tuesday? Could I come up and visit?" He said, "Mike, nothing definite, just doing some adjusting in the newsroom, always willing to talk to anyone, just curious why you got out of the business. It's been quite a while now, and changes have been big, Bill." And so I fired off an explanation to Bill, because I don't get the chance to talk about it much, I guess. I said, "I got out because I wanted to write about big stuff. I wanted to see what I had in me as far as novels. I wanted to see if I was John Steinbeck, I suppose. I had to find out. I got into newspaper work from the peace movement, jail, prison, and I just got burned out on jail and prison. I wanted to continue my activism and thought I could do it through newspaper work. My first job was in Haynesworth, Nebraska during the first Gulf War. I finally got the publisher to give me my own column, and as it turned out, that coincided with the start of the war. I said, 'I don't support the troops.' Column canceled. I quit. We finally bought a small paper in southeast Minnesota, in Byron. We got the Newspaper of the Year award from MNA in 94 and went out of business that same year. Then Cherokee, Iowa, a small daily, and I got to be the editor. I still was wanting to advance, get to the big paper. I got to the Northwest Iowa Review, only a weekly, but it often earns the best weekly award for the country. And I just got fed up, I guess. I wanted to say more, and I just felt the only way was through the unlikely, though possible, route of novels. I ran for Congress in 2000 as an unemployed, unpublished novelist, by selling that to the conservative, skeptical political reporters of the Des Moines Register. But I got the Democratic nomination and 65,000 votes in the general on an anti-war, anti-prison platform in a conservative district. I self-published, found small publishers to help me, worked on some nonfiction projects, took a couple around-the-country book tours, resisted war taxes, walked from Sheldon, Iowa to Fort Dodge to try to stop Clinton from bombing Yugoslavia, stuff like that. I began working in group homes the same month as 9/11 and have been working in them ever since in Iowa and Minnesota while publishing novels that nobody reads, but I still feel I have to write. And well, I'm just finishing up the last of a series of three of the latest, have submitted them to contests, and when they don't win, I'll probably try to publish them in some manner myself. And I've been in group homes for a long time and writing novels for a long time, and I remember how much fun newspaper work was. I feel deep in my heart that the American media is to blame for the state of our country, not telling the truth about 9/11 and so many other things, corporate owners who are in cahoots with the government. I talk about all that in my books and on a weekly Thursday night radio show, The New American Dream. But I love the newsroom, the tiny ones I was associated with. Ruth and I ran the Byron Review out of our home. It was a lot of fun, and I was thinking it might be pretty great to be able to get a taste of that again. Well, sorry, that was too much, but for better or worse, you know me better now." And Bill Hanna's response, "Certainly respect anyone's opinions, but with such advocacy, don't see you as a fit in a very good small daily newspaper. We are about good community journalism, not novels or anti-war views or chasing 9/11 theories or blaming the media. Thanks for your comments and good luck." Well, thanks to Penn Jones Jr., at least the entire history of American journalism, small town and big town, has not been a disgrace. And I think it also bears mentioning at this point that the German journalists who supported and carried out the Nazi propaganda were also put on trial at Nuremberg. And that exchange with Bill Hanna, a longtime American journalist, reminds me of who I am, why I'm doing this. Reminds me of the day that I quit the Ainsworth Star Journal after my column was canceled because I said I do not support the troops. Did you see the piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education about how the CIA helped to fund the Iowa Writers' Workshop in order to influence creative writing in America to fit the American Cold War stance? Have you heard of Project Mockingbird? Do you read newspapers anymore? Watch the news on TV? Listen to the news on your local radio station? Is there anywhere, any place left to go in America? Well, it's all closing in, been closing in for years, closing up tight. But we are not giving up. This is Thursday night, a night of hope. And this is the New American Dream Radio Show, live from Duluth, Fort Lauderdale, Coral Gables, somewhere in Spain, and New York.
And now a word from special New American Dream Ukraine correspondent Harvey Harrelson, who for many years wrote the popular column for Mad Magazine entitled An Old Man, A Very Old Man on a Park Bench. Harvey Harrelson writes, geopolitical conditions today are incendiary. Obama's war on Syria rages, no end in sight. Washington manipulated peace talks to fail. Odds favor full-scale U.S. intervention. Doing so risks regional war. Washington and Israel partner in regional adventurism. Are they planning regional conflict? Will Iran be targeted? Will U.S.-orchestrated Venezuelan violence continue? Will other nations be targeted for regime change? The damn fool in the White House risks global war. Ukraine is a major flashpoint. Conditions today are the most dangerous since the 1962 Missiles of October crisis. Jack Kennedy was president. Early in his administration, he changed from cold warrior to peacemaker. He wanted all nuclear weapons abolished. He favored general and complete disarmament. He wanted all U.S. forces out of Vietnam by December 1965. He wanted to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. After resolving the 1962 crisis, he said he never had the slightest intention of confronting Cuba or Soviet Russia aggressively. A damn fool in the White House is no Jack Kennedy. Neocons infest his administration. Rogue elements make policy. Ousting Ukraine's democratically elected government was planned long before violence erupted last November. Obama partnered with neo-Nazis extremists. He's got a tiger by the tail. Millions of Ukrainians reject them, expect millions more to join them once their agenda becomes apparent. The damn fool in the White House risks war. He outrageously warned Putin against intervening. Harvey Harrelson, sidebar. If you look out your window, you'll see playing again in all theaters, E.T., the extraterrestrial. It's the 1980s again. Walmart has a book sale in the cat food aisle. Hunt for Red October, Red Storm Rising. They're duck and cover billboards littering the highways, and Hollywood celebrities warned us during the recent Oscar awards not to eat snow. Michelle Obama and Mrs. Biden, whatever her name is, both have the new beehive hairdos in an attempt to take the country back to the future. It's the Cold War all over again. The Manchurian Candidate, House Un-American Activities Committee, Catholic Legion of Decency, Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideal, Dr. Strangelove, Red Dawn. In his closing statement at the Olympic Games, Vladimir Putin said, "Mr. Obama, tear down that wall. pointing directly at the Arizona-Mexico border. Tom Clancy, James Bond, Octopus, the man with the golden gun, Man from U.N.C.L.E., Rocky and Bullwinkle Show, I Spy, Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. It's all there in the boxes in the closet of the basement, all ready to break open again. George H.W. Bush made sure there was no peace dividend when the Berlin Wall came down. And now we know why. Barbie dolls, the perfect symbol of the American zeitgeist, now selling like hotcakes. And this time, we're really going to beat them to the moon. NASA's announced plans to send a dog and a monkey and Toby Keith on an exploratory mission to Grosse Pointe, Michigan next month. We now know from our study of the first Cold War, the FBI set up a surveillance operation in Hollywood, made efforts to pinpoint and blacklist communists, secretly laundered intelligence through HUAC, and further helped in producing movies that fostered the FBI image as the protector of the American people. The FBI additionally endorsed films, including Oscar winners. Well, thanks to Project Mockingbird, Bill Clinton, the Bushes, and Barack Obama, we won't have to go to too much trouble to reach role. And as we heard our beloved president in his national radio message yesterday, as he accepted his second Nobel Peace Prize, my fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
We'd now like to welcome our first guest of the evening, Mickey Z. Mickey Z is a writer and activist in New York City. He's a regular on our show every month. Chuck will be getting him lined up here. I believe Mickey lives in Queens. I think that's where, at least that's where he grew up.
Well, we're glad to welcome back Mickey Z. And Mickey did a presentation last night. I think it was at Blue Stockings, and I hope you'll tell us about it.
Yeah, we were at Blue Stockings Bookstore here in New York City, and we did a screening of the documentary Blackfish, and followed by a discussion with a couple of people that are volunteers with Sea Shepherd. And I did a short talk, and then we had some Q&A, and it was really well attended. You know, we still have a very, very cold winter weather here, yet people still came out on a weeknight. So we had a great crowd. We had some free vegan food there, which people were happy about. And a really lively discussion afterwards. So I would have to say that it was a really successful event. We were happy with it.
Well, people always come for free food.
Yeah, that's something that we learned, without a doubt. And if you are presenting a movie that's going to have, for example, an animal rights angle or some type of vegan angle, it certainly helps to have food available where some people who might have never tried what they would consider to be a vegan meal would say, hey, this stuff is pretty good. So not only are we feeding people that might be hungry, but we're also sharing the food that we like. So it definitely is a really useful component of any event.
Well, that's a very good point. Can you tell us a little more about the film?
Well, the movie is a documentary about the captivity of orcas in general, but in particular, it follows the path of this one particular orca who was named Tillicum, that ended up at SeaWorld, that it turns out is responsible for at least two deaths of trainers, and is kept in captivity primarily as a source for breeding. So the number they give in the movie is something like 54% of the orcas in the SeaWorld empire had shared Tillicum's genes, and he lived a very, like any animal in captivity, he lived a very tortured life, but in particular, since he moved around a lot and was often attacked by female orcas, that's the very matriarchal culture, it's believed that he had a lot more issues. And so the movie itself discusses animal captivity as a concept, but what they do brilliantly is that they do a chunk of interviews with former trainers and how they were manipulated and, in many cases, injured and put in severe risk. Excuse me. And I think the reason why the movie resonated with the general public is because, is because it focused on these humans who you could relate to, anyone can relate to being manipulated and being forced into a situation where you don't want to lose your job, you don't want to be the odd man out, so if you see something going on, you don't really say anything, and now after a while they all came out and started talking about what really happened. And the movie itself has been quite a gift to the animal rights community in the sense that it has a mainstream population. It was shown on CNN, and people are talking about the concept of animal captivity as they never have before. So as an activist, I feel it's our job to now capitalize on this opening and then discuss all forms of captivity of all species. And so the discussion last night covered a lot of ground in that sense.
Well, you know, another thing that's happened recently that really bumped up the visibility of this animal captivity thing was the Copenhagen Zoo that killed a giraffe.
No, absolutely. In fact, I mentioned that in my talk last night in the sense that I was reminding people that the problems with animal captivity, and one of the points that is very rarely even focused on is that these most forms of animal captivity, if not all, are businesses. So they're looking to draw in customers to raise money, and one of the most common and successful ways to do so is what they call cute babies. So they either take babies from the wild, but now more and more they've been engaging in captive breeding. So when the animals of any species are young, they're magnets. They could come out, we have a new baby, and come on in, and the crowds file in. And then when they reach a certain age, these facilities call them literally surplus. And that's the case of the animal, the giraffe in Copenhagen, which specifically this poor creature was considered surplus. And this is a predictable offshoot of the business of captivity and captive breeding, which does nothing to help create robust animal populations in the wild, but does a whole lot to make money for zoos and circuses and rodeos and aquariums and so on under the guise of either helping endangered species or conservation. But they're businesses, plain and simple, and these animals are commodities to them.
That's strictly an entertainment industry.
Absolutely.
So what else? You mentioned the weather's been continuing to be really cold, but what else is going on up there in New York?
The people that I'm involved in with animal rights have been really active. We are building up, trying to resurrect other forms of activism here in New York, and there is talk that on April 4th, which is about a month away, on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's death, that there's going to sort of be a relaunching of some real steady activism globally, but I can speak for New York, New York-wise, and maybe trying to revitalize the Occupy movement going in towards May Day. So I'd say outside of my animal rights work, the one group that seems most active up here are those who are stepping up against the fracking pipelines and all different forms of fossil fuels, fracking in particular. And so that is pretty steady. But it's been a little bit disconcerting how a lot of other forms of activism have dropped off. So I'm trying to be optimistic that perhaps April 4th will be a relaunching of a variety of other movements, including Occupy, which would be really exciting and much needed.
It certainly is. I do hope that will happen.
Absolutely. And on a more personal level, I'm continuing to do events where we work often with Blue Stockings, as I mentioned, and also Hunter College. And we're going to show a movie on March 15th called Speciesism, which discusses the hierarchies of the animal rights within the realm of speciesism compared to racism, sexism, and so on. And the director of the film will be there. And we're going to show Blackfish again in late March with at Hunter College with one of the former trainers from SeaWorld is going to be there. So we're keeping, because of the colder weather, we're keeping this pattern of indoor events and screenings, and it really seems to resonate with folks to come in, be able to sit in a radical setting with meeting new people, get to see a movie. Like I said, we often have free food, and then there's a big discussion afterwards, and we're discovering that this format right now seems to be the one that is packing houses. People want to come in and meet as a community, and I think it's crucial because, you know, we've had this conversation before. There's an awful lot of activists that do solely all their work on social media, and I find that it really, if you're able to get out and you have people within your geographical area, it's crucial that you meet. It's crucial that you, that's where you can brainstorm and really get to know each other and develop solidarity and come up with ways to, more effective ways to try and create some change. And so this is what we've been doing here up here in New York over this cold winter, and I'm happy to say that the format is working, but I'm also looking forward to the warmer weather when we can do a lot more meetings outside too.
Yeah. What you're describing sounds almost like what used to happen in Greenwich Village in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. Because in no way do I would I say, oh, we came up with this new format. I think we've kind of rediscovered something that perhaps got shoved to the side in the realm of all the new forms of technology and communication, where it's like you don't need to do that. If you wanted to watch Blackfish, you would send someone the link and they would watch it on their iPhone. But I don't have to tell you that the experience of watching it in a room filled with people who are curious to learn is infinitely different than sitting alone and watching it on a small device and then texting someone and saying, wow, that was really cool. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that. And there are some folks, especially in cold weather, who are forever health reasons and so on, or, you know, have to take care of their kids or whatever, they can't get out. And I'm not downplaying that. But if you can get...
Thanks to Mickey Z. Sorry the interview got cut off a little bit.
We'd now like to welcome our second guest of the night, Ole Damgaard. Ole is a conspiracy researcher and much more. But that's what we're going to talk about tonight is the JFK conspiracy, I believe. Chuck conducted this interview with Ole this past week, and Chuck is going to get Ole on the line here or dial up that pre-recorded interview.
Today I would like to speak to you about James Files. James Files is the person who claims to be the one that was behind the picket fence and fired the final headshot that blew up JFK's head. There's been a lot of controversy, is that how you say it, around if he's believable or not. And I put a lot of time into investigating everything he's been claiming and so on. And I must say, I find him very, very believable. And if you look at it and also see that he has absolutely nothing to gain from coming forward with this, also how he was, it took a long time for him to come forward, and only because of the very personal circumstances. He even turned down people like Oliver Stone and other people like that who offered him money. He never spoke to them. But if we listen to what he says and the details, there are some very, very important jigsaw puzzles in the whole conspiracy mystery around JFK. So I would just like to give you a quick run through of his background and so on. I think one of the most important things is also to see that it was not only in the JFK assassination that he took a main part. He also later, he was working very closely to some of the members in Operation 40, this team of assassins that was very deeply involved in JFK and many, many, many other assassinations. And later he was also part in the overtake of Allende. He was there when Allende was shot dead in the stairs. He was very deeply involved in the Iran-Contra. He was in Vietnam. He was the one that delivered the explosive for the bomb to blow up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C. And he was also the one who delivered the explosive to blow up the Cuban airliner, killing 76 people in Barbados. He was also part of delivering explosives in Libya together with a man called Tom Wilson, I think his name was, who was also a member of Operation 40. This is not that many years ago. But I think that gives him a lot of credibility because he continued very successfully within this area of assassins. Anyway, if we go back, he was born in the early 1940s, and when he was about 16 years old, his sister was murdered by her husband. So he took the law in his own hands and blew the head off this guy with a shotgun. Like I say, he was only 16. And after that, he went to the army. He was recruited, and he entered the airborne, the 82 airborne. And after that, he was transported to Laos. So he was one of the first people there, being part of this group of military advisors, as they were called. While he was there, a thing happened where he had to, I'm not sure about the exact details, but he somehow had to show his loyalty to this Laotian military. And this ended with him executing two of his own people with headshots. Anyway, after that, he was sent back, and he was in a military hospital for reevaluation, when he was approached by a man by the name of Ted Shackley. Ted Shackley was a very, very high up CIA operative who was also very central in Dealey Plaza and many, many, many other assassinations internationally. And Ted Shackley then recommended James Filty, so that he had a potential as a future assassin. And he contacted David Attlee Phillips, who was the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald and many other assassins as well. So David Attlee Phillips came to the military hospital and recruited him to the CIA. So from that day, when he was 19 or 20 or something like that, he went back to Chicago where he came from, and he did some jobs on and off for the CIA. But at the same time, he was driving stock cars and so on, and he was in a neighborhood where the mob was very powerful. While he was there, he was observed by Chucky Nicoletti, who was one of San Giancana's hitmen or henchmen. And this Chucky Nicoletti, who was also one of the shooters, he was, according to my research, he was the shooter in the Daltex building. Anyway, when Chucky saw how good he was with cars and weapons and so on, he asked him if he would become his partner, sort of like driver, taking care of the cars, run errands and so on. He was like not on a very high level. He was just the young kid that took care of stuff and was a really good driver, but also knew about weapons and these things. So he took part of a lot of the killings in the Chicago area when the mob was dealing with their enemies and so on. Then it came to a point where, in the summer of 1963, that Chucky Nicoletti was at a meeting. I think General Rosselli was there as well. And when he came out there, he said that, apparently we're going to hit your friend. When he said your friend, James Files thought that he meant some guy in Chicago and so, but it turned out that it was actually JFK that they were going for. So, and James Files had absolutely no problem with that because he was also part of training people for the JFK invasion, and he was very, very upset with Kennedy, blaming him, as so many others did, for the lack of air support, making this whole Bay of Pigs, let's hope, a fiasco. Anyway, so he said, no problem at all, I'll be there for you. And because also he was in absolute awe of Chucky Nicoletti. He was like a god to him. He really was, according to what he says himself. Anyway, so he got the task to the drive. It was a Chevy Impala, 1963, a burgundy colored car that was a so-called work car with loads of weapons inside. It was bulletproof size. It had one of these number plates that could rotate. It had gun racks in the seats and so on. He was supposed to bring the guns to Dallas. And at the same time, Chuck Nicoletti got to Arizona. I'm not sure how. He went there, met up with Chauncey Holt, the CIA operative, and some other assassins. They met at Peter Licavoli's ranch, Grace Ranch, in Arizona. And from there on, they were supposed to fly to Dallas, but the luggage was so heavy with whatever weapons and things they were carrying as well. So instead, they took a car from them, a Chevy Impala, I've been told it's called. And anyway, so they came there, and James Files drove down to Dallas on his own. He went into and stayed at what is called the Limelight Hotel in the East, just outside Dallas. And while he was there like 5 days before the assassination. The next morning, no one less than Lee Harvey Oswald came knocking on the door. And the only two people that knew that James Files was there this day was David I.P. Phillips, the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, and James Files, and Chuck Nicoletti. So it's quite obvious that it was David I.P. Phillips who had sent Oswald there. Anyway, Oswald helped Files over the next few days to calibrate the weapon. He didn't shoot himself, it was Files that did everything. But he showed him where he could test fire the guns. He also took him around in Dallas, showing him the whole area and so on. And I just want to make it clear that I personally feel that Lee Harvey Oswald was trying to infiltrate. He thought that his task was to infiltrate this group of assassins, not that he was part of it, not that he was guilty in any way. Files and Oswald didn't talk about the assassination at all. It was not mentioned, which is common when it comes to these assassinations, because if you start talking too much or asking too much, very shortly you will be among the dead ones. So they were talking about hamburgers, girls, nothing more important than that. Anyway, when it came to the actual day of the assassination, Johnny Rosselli had flown down with many of the other shooters and the teams that were there. And there was given an order, I don't know from where, but somewhere within the CIA to abort the whole operation. So just half an hour or 45 minutes before the assassination, this order came, and Chuck Nicoletti, he just said, "Shit, I'm not going to cancel here. The only one that can cancel this one is Sam Giancana, who was staying at the Adolphus Hotel and who is the head of the Chicago mob, very involved with the CIA and the rest of this whole conspiracy." So, but Johnny Rosselli got cold feet because he didn't want to make problems with the CIA and so on. So he said, "I'm not going to be in this." So he was with Chuck Nicoletti in the Daltex building, but instead, Chucky asked James Files if he would stand by as a shooter as well, just in case. And James Files, since he really admired Chucky Nicoletti, said, "I'll be most happy to do that for you." So they looked around, and Files decided to get up in the position behind the picket fence. There were shooters all over, which I've been going into great detail before. Explaining, but he was the one who positioned himself behind the picket fence, and he was there in a he had a jacket that on the inside it looked like a lumberjack red and I don't know what you call that padding type of thing, and on the outside it was a gray almost shiny type of cloth. So anyway, what he did was he turned it inside out. And so that he could very easily, after the shooting, just turn it the other way around again and then change appearance. Plus that he had a hat on as well. He had what he did was that he parked the Chevy Impala behind the Daltex building. He reversed it up so that Chucky Nicoletti and Johnny Rosselli, who was in the Daltex building together with the spotted Nestor Izquierdo from Operation Porter, and also, if my research is correct, George Bush Sr. was also in that building because he was there as the funder and also from the CIA to take part of the assassination. Anyway, so the five parked it there so that they could get straight from the rear door into the car. The guy that opened the door and let them in was a Chicago figure from Los Angeles by the name of Hayes Grading. Anyway, so Fires positioned himself behind the picket fence, and what he did, he had a little case, and in that he had a very special weapon. It was a weapon that at that time was not in production for ordinary people. It was the CIA who was taking part of developing it, and it was an XP-100 Remington Fireball. It looks like a little it looks like a rifle but with a pistol grip, and very precise on short distances, and it's the perfect weapon for hitting single action and just one bullet, .222. And what he had done was that he had a guy, a specialist in Chicago that helped them up with a weapon. This man was called Wolfman, and with the support of him, they had drilled the tops of the bullets, drilled a hole in the top and then filled it up with mercury and then wax. The reason for this was that this weapon was notorious for if you didn't hit straight on in the head, or if you went for a headshot, it could very easily ricochet off the skull. So because of that, he made it sort of like he used like explosive ammo, also because that would help to for ballistics and so on, because the bullet would just disappear. Anyway, so he was positioned there, and he was standing waiting. So when the motorcade came around the corners, the only thing that he was focused on was a headshot. Chucky Nicoletti had informed him, we are aiming for a headshot, that's the only thing, and do not fire if it's not absolutely necessary. So Fires was standing there, and the shooting started, and he wasn't counting the shots, he was counting the misses, because he saw that Kennedy was being hit, but not a headshot. So he waited, and then just when the limo came and almost stopped in front of the grassy knoll, he just thought, this is, I can't let this go. So he fired, and he hit the president right in the right temple, just above the right eye. And but just a microsecond before he hit, he noticed that the head was thrown forward by a headshot from behind. Anyway, as soon as the motorcade took off, he was big-headed at that time. He was 21 and thought that not untouchable type of thing. So what he did was, for some stupid reason, as he says himself, he took the shell, and he when he had killed somebody, he also always tasted the powder, the gun. He had this love for gunpowder. So what he did was he tasted the gunpowder and then bit on the casing, put it on the fence, and then bent down, got the gun in the case, turned the jacket inside out, put on a hat, and then slowly walked along the picket fence towards the Delphix building, behind the Texas School Book Depository, totally prepared. He had a Colt 45 in his left hand. If somebody had approached him, he would just have shot them there. Anyway, he wasn't approached, and what he did was he went straight over behind the Daltech building, got in the car. Osetti was in the back, Nicoletti was in the front, and what they did was they took off right away, went north on Houston Street. They went four or five blocks, then took a left underneath the Stemmons Freeway, and there was a gas station there where he dropped these two people off. He had no idea how they left Dallas and so on. And this is quite detailed what happened this day with this guy. This shell was found many years later, I think it was in 1987 or something like that, but down in the ground. Somebody had stepped on it maybe or something, it was down there. And there are these very specific dents that a dentist had examined, and he said it is somebody has bitten on this one. And this was not something that was known by anyone, more or less, when James Files said this. also the dental records, because he's got fake false teeth now, but the dental records that he used, the teeth he had when this happened, it's still kept by the FBI, and they refuse to give it up. So I just want to say, this man has an incredible amount of information, and very, very reliable, I would say. Also, he's got a very high codex of honor, if you can speak about that, being an assassin, but I think you can. These people, they would rather die than give up someone else. So all the information that he's giving is only about dead people. He never mentioned anybody else that are still alive and so on. I just want to say one more thing, is also that one day, not a lot of people, very, very few, I would say, knew about his part in this JFK assassination. As far as he knew, it was only David Abbey Phillips and a few others. But one day when he was part of Operation 40 and so on, Ted Chiaki, the CIA guy I mentioned before, he said that he overheard a conversation where Ted Chiaki said that they actually dumped the body of the president in the sea, that the grave is today is empty, and that they got rid of the body by throwing it out at sea after the autopsies, and because there was so much controversy, and I think they were afraid of the body being taken out of the grave and re-examined. So if this is true or not, I do not know. I just want to share this. That he also claims that he was the one who drove Chucky Nicoletti and two or three other people the morning on the 4th of August 1962, I think it was, when Marilyn Monroe was killed or murdered. And he said he was the one who drove them to a small airport outside Chicago for them to fly to L.A. and take care of her. And the reason why she was killed, according to the file, is that she was carrying JFK's baby, and that she did not have an affair with Robert Kennedy. The reason he was there so many times and so on was to try and persuade her to get rid of this child, but she refused. And she was getting more and more dangerous because she was talking all the time and she was on all of these pills and so on. So JFK actually approached Sam Giancana saying, could you please help me with this problem? And Sam Giancana agreed to take care of Marilyn Monroe in this way. Once again, if this is true or not, I do not know. But I know that everything else that I've been able to confirm when it comes to what James Spicer said has been absolutely accurate and exact. So I think these are things that it's important for it to get out there. This was before JFK had a fallout with the mob, and before he put his brother to chase them down. This was early on while they were still so-called friends. And that was all for today.
Well, that was a mouthful. That was an amazing amount of detail. And I really had not heard of this guy before, so it was just fascinating. I thank you so much for being with us on the radio show.
You're welcome, Chuck.
Okay, and we'll talk to you again next month.
Yes, thank you. My website, as always, is lightonconspiracies.com, lightonconspiracies.com, and my book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion.
Well, that was an amazingly detailed description from Ole Domigar. I understand that some people may have a little trouble understanding Ole, and so I'm going to run down a few of the main points of what he was talking about. He's talking about James Files, who is supposed to have been an additional shooter in the JFK assassination, who was behind the picket fence. Files was in the military in Laos, was involved with the CIA, was involved with the mob, ended up partnering up with Chuck Nicoletti in Chicago. And primarily he was a driver rather than a hitman, but he was also a gun specialist and an excellent marksman, and he knew a lot about guns. And he got recruited in the summer of 63 for a hit, which turned out to be the hit on JFK. He was using, they did something, we're about out of time. And now, some notes we've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, cell phone, telepathy, and telegraph. Inga from Baraboo. Happy anniversary, Mom and Dad. Already missing you. Wish you were here. We're lost. We're kidding. Hugs, hugs. Kisses, kisses. Jim from Jacksonville. Just want to send a shout out to all the guys back in the dorm and just say this. Ignored reality is going to wipe out the human race. To inform people is hard slugging. Everything is lined up against the public being informed, or the policymakers for that matter. News is contaminated by its service to special interests and hidden agendas. Many scientists or their employers are dependent on federal money. Even psychologists and anthropologists were roped into the government's torture and occupation program. Economists tell lies for corporations and Wall Street. Plant and soil scientists tell lies for agribusiness and Monsanto. Truth tellers are slandered and persecuted. However, persistence can eventually win out. In the long run, truth sometimes emerges, but not always, and not always in time.
Elaine from Crookston says, go Knicks. Can I just say this quickly about our invisible revolution? Did you ever ask yourself how it happens that government and capitalism continue to exist in spite of all the evil and trouble they are causing in the world? If you did, then your answer must have been that it is because the people support those institutions, and that they support them because they believe in them. As long as most citizens believe in the ideas that justify global capitalism, the private and state institutions that serve our corporate masters are unassailable. When these ideas are shattered, the institutions that buttress the ruling class deflate and collapse. The battle of ideas is percolating below the surface. It is a battle the corporate state is steadily losing. An increasing number of Americans are getting it. They know that we have been stripped of political power. They recognize that we have been shorn of our most basic and cherished civil liberties and live under the gaze of the most intrusive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. Half the country lives in poverty. Many of the rest of us, if the corporate state is not overthrown, will join them. These truths are no longer hidden. It appears that political ferment is dormant in the United States. This is incorrect. The ideas that sustain the corporate state are swiftly losing their efficacy across the political spectrum. The ideas that are rising to take their place, however, are inchoate. The right has retreated into Christian fascism and a celebration of the gun culture. The left, knocked off balance by decades of fair state repression, in the name of anti-communism, is struggling to rebuild and define itself. Popular revulsion for the ruling elite, however, is nearly universal. It is a question of which ideas will capture the public's imagination. Revolution usually erupts over events that would, in normal circumstances, be considered meaningless or minor acts of injustice by the state. But once the tinder of revolt has piled up as it has in the United States, an insignificant spark easily ignites popular rebellion. No person or movement can ignite this tinder. No one knows where or when the eruption will take place. No one knows the form it will take. But it is certain now that a popular revolt is coming. The refusal by the corporate state to address even the minimal grievances of the citizenry, along with the abject failure to remedy the mounting state repression, the chronic unemployment and underemployment, the massive alienage that is crippling more than half of Americans, and the lost hope and widespread despair means that blowback is inevitable. Because revolution is evolution, at its boiling point you cannot make a real revolution any more than you can hasten the boiling of a tea kettle, Berkman wrote. It is the fire underneath that makes it boil. How quickly it will come to the boiling point will depend on how strong the fire is. Revolutions, when they erupt, appear to the elites and the establishment to be sudden and unexpected. This is because the real work of revolutionary ferment and consciousness is unseen by the mainstream society, noticed only after it has largely been completed. Once ideas shift for a large portion of a population, once the vision of a new society grips the popular imagination, the old regime is finished. By the time ruling elites are openly defied, there has already been a nearly total loss of faith in the ideas, in our case, free market capitalism and globalization, that sustain the structures of the ruling elites. And once enough people get it, a process that can take years, the slow, quiet, and peaceful social evolution becomes quick, militant, and violent. As Berkman wrote, evolution becomes revolution. This is where we are headed.
This note from Kareem from Santa Barbara. Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm on the radio. December 2012, a pink-haired complex systems researcher named Brad Werner made his way through the throng of 24,000 Earth and space scientists at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union held annually in San Francisco. It was titled, Is Earth Effed? Full title, Is Earth Effed? Dynamical Futility of Global Environmental Management and Possibilities for Sustainability via Direct Action Activism. Standing at the front of the conference room, the geophysicist from the University of California, San Diego, walked the crowd through the advanced computer model he was using to answer that question. He talks about system boundaries, perturbation, dissipation, attractors, bifurcation, and a whole bunch of other stuff largely incomprehensible to those of us uninitiated in complex systems theory. But the bottom line was clear enough. Global capitalism has made the depletion of resources so rapid, convenient, and barrier-free that Earth-human systems are becoming dangerously unstable in response. When pressed by a journalist for a clear answer on the are we effed question, Werner set the jargon aside and replied, more or less. There was one dynamic in the model, however, that offered some hope. Werner termed it resistance. Movements of people or groups of people who adopt a certain set of dynamics that does not fit within the capitalist culture. According to the abstract for his presentation, this includes environmental direct action, resistance taken from outside the dominant culture, as in protests, blockades, and sabotage by indigenous peoples, workers, anarchists, and other activist groups. Serious scientific gatherings don't usually feature calls for mass political resistance, much less direct action and sabotage. But then again, Werner wasn't exactly calling for those things. He was merely observing that mass uprisings of people, along the lines of the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, or Occupy Wall Street, represent the likeliest source of friction to slow down an economic machine that is careening out of control. We know that past social movements have had tremendous influence on how the dominant culture evolved, he pointed out. So it stands to reason that if we're thinking about the future of the Earth and the future of our coupling to the environment, we have to include resistance as part of that dynamics. And that, Warner argued, is not a matter of opinion, but really a geophysics problem.
Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, cell phone, telepathy, and telegraph. Our third guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross. Sherwood Ross is a legendary reporter. He worked at the Chicago News Service. He worked with Martin Luther King. He wrote speeches for Mayor Daley. And Chuck will be trying to contact him in Coral Gables so we can hear what Sherwood has to say. Hey, Chuck.
Hello, Sherwood. Welcome.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Well, tonight I'd like to dedicate this broadcast to Medea Benjamin. She's the heroic founder of the peace organization Code Pink. This Benjamin was just beaten up by Egyptian secret police the other day, and surprisingly, one man with every motive to order that hit is none other than President Barack Obama, and this should be investigated by Congress. I'll explain all this in a minute, but first, please, if you want to protest the arrest and torture of Medea Benjamin, get out your checkbook and write 1-2 Code Pink, 2010 Linden Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. That's 2010 Linden Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. And I'll repeat this address later. First, let's take a look at the facts. En route to a women's conference in Gaza, Benjamin was detained at Cairo Airport by Egyptian secret police, who stopped her from entering Gaza. When she protested, they stomped on her, knocked her to the ground, dislocated her shoulder, and then painfully handcuffed her hands behind her back. This compounded her suffering, and her wrists began to bleed. The cowards refused her medical aid, and they sat on either side of her during the flight, taking her out of the country and dumping her in Istanbul, Turkey. Now, before that flight, the doctors in Egypt said Benjamin wasn't fit to make the flight, but the goons paid them no mind. The goons also stopped Nobel Prize winner Myriad Maguire of Northern Ireland from entering Gaza. During her imprisonment in Cairo, the American embassy refused to take Benjamin's part or to protest to Egyptian authorities over Ms. Benjamin's treatment. And nobody in the State Department bawled out the Egyptians for their crime. The silence of the American embassy suggests that the U.S. may have actually ordered Benjamin's arrest and torture. Consider this. The Egyptians had no reason for brutalizing the lady, but President Obama had every reason for so doing. It was Benjamin who interrupted Obama's speech last May at the National Defense University in Washington by heckling him over his use of killer drones. Drones that have now killed thousands of innocent people, including several hundred children. I repeat, children. At the time she was removed from Obama's presence, Ms. Benjamin said, quote,
I must say I do really appreciate that I live in a country where if you interrupt the president, you don't get beaten and tortured and thrown inside a prison for a year, end quote. That, of course, was last May. Now, this courageous peace activist is learning otherwise the hard way. You can be thrown in prison, beaten, and tortured. And if you think it's improbable that Obama might take revenge against Benjamin, consider he repeatedly orders illegal drone strikes against his enemies. These are illegal murders without court orders. And that's just what Benjamin was heckling him about in back in Washington. Also consider this, the U.S. has a long history of the CIA kidnapping people and transporting them to countries including Egypt, Morocco, and Lithuania to be tortured. What we may well have here is one more case of Washington ordering its Egyptian lackeys to help it punish its enemies. I mean, do you think that Cairo would torture a prominent American pacifist without a green light from the White House? Mr. Obama reportedly has told his staff, "I didn't know I'd be so good at killing." Well, I mean, the man has got to be good at something. And beating up a 60-year-old peace activist deserves your response. It deserves a congressional investigation now. For your part, you can give generously to Code Pink. Join today. That's 2010 Linden Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. That's 2010 Linden Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. I'm sure with Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Sherwood, thank you so much for your commentary. And that's bringing this out about Medea Benjamin and Code Pink is, to me, it's a new idea. I have not seen other people talking about this, and I'm so glad that you brought it to our attention and our listeners' attention.
Well, it looks so much like a revenge hit, you know, and the CIA has a reputation of arresting people, kidnapping them off the streets, and then taking them to another country where they're beaten up and tortured. So here's another case where an American pacifist was taken off the streets, so to speak, in Cairo and beaten up and tortured by the Egyptians. And it wasn't the idea of the Egyptians. You can bet on that. We need a congressional investigation of this probable crime.
Well, I think you're quite right there.
Have a good night, Chuck.
All right. Well, thank you, Sherwood. Mike, what did you think about that?
I had heard about the event, but I'd never heard about that. I had never considered that angle. I think that's very interesting, and I think it's a good thing that Sherwood got it out there. I wonder if he'll be able to be writing an article for that on Veterans Today. That would be a good place to put it, too. Did you want to, Chuck, did you want to mention anything about Mickey Z's book that he has for sale that we didn't get to talk about?
Oh, yes. Yes. That interview got a little bit cut off. We didn't get a chance to tell the listeners about Occupy This Book. That's you can find it just by searching for that on the internet. I think it's Sullivan Street Press is his publisher, and it's currently out as an ebook and will be offered in print fairly soon. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm going to be getting a copy very soon, and I look forward to reading it. It's like a manual for activism.
You're the publisher of one of his books, aren't you? What book is that?
Yes, I published his book, No Innocent Bystanders, which is a fascinating book, and it's still still selling a little bit. Certainly still available, either at cwgpress.com or at Amazon. And Mickey Z is really a fascinating guy.
Does he make you? He puts. Whenever I hear him, I think, "Oh God, I'm not doing nothing." You know, he says, "Don't eat meat. Don't eat this. Don't do that." You know, one time I know it was about it was a couple of years ago. I said, "Okay, I'm going to be vegan," and I emailed Mickey Z. I said, "Okay, I'm a vegan," and I'm not sure if that lasted 10 minutes or 15 minutes, but I have tried.
Yeah. I've never been able to make that jump either. I mean, not only am I not vegan, I'm not even vegetarian. I'm a carnivore.
Me too. But you know, to me, on an intellectual level, I agree with that. I would say, close down the slaughterhouses. Don't hunt. Don't kill deer. Don't kill bears. Don't kill moose. Don't do any of that. Don't cut down the forest. That's what I would do if I was president. I don't know if that's what you would do or not, but then you hear somebody like Mickey Z, who is actually, he's doing it. He's living it. He's not just thinking about it. He's actually doing it, and it's just I think it's cool to there is somebody like that out there, and we can all aspire to that.
Exactly so. We humans are also full of contradictions. We believe something, but we just don't do it. And when you see somebody that really gets out there and lives what they believe in, it's fantastic. Richard Flamer is another one like that.
Next week we'll have Richard Flamer and Jim Fetzer, and I think we're going to also have Chris Cook. Chris Cook is a DJ, radio show host. It's called Gorilla Radio, Gorilla Radio in Vancouver. And I'd be interested to see what he's going to have to say. And Richard's always, I don't know if Richard is he back from, I wonder if he'll be in Iowa still or if he'll be in Mexico.
I think he was supposed to be headed back to Mexico. I haven't been in touch with him since last month, but hopefully he's back in Mexico.
Have you ever heard Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett's weekly radio show on No Lies? It's on Thursday, I think Thursday morning.
No, I haven't had the chance to listen. Have you listened to it?
Yeah, I try to do that every week before I'm getting ready for this show. I put that on, and it's a really a good update and the news, and I just don't, I don't read newspapers, I don't listen to watch TV news. I go to the internet, and I guess that, I just don't trust certain things, I guess.
Well, I'm the same way. People ask me, well, did you see this on TV? I said, well, no, but I did read about it on the internet.
I do watch, when the kids were younger, I remember I would take the TV downstairs to the basement, and then, but the next couple of days, I hauled it back up. I couldn't resist. Okay. And now, sponsored by Carnival Cruise Lines, another episode of Barack Obama, I'm the King of the World. In this episode, we will see King Barack standing in the front of the USA Titanic with his arms outstretched, his mouth open, and shouting. What is he shouting? And what is that out there in the dark? Well, looks like that's all the time we have. And now, tonight, our New American Dream Company will present an excerpt from a speech given by Harold Pinter while accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature 2005. His talk was entitled Art, Truth, and Politics.
politicians, on the evidence available to us, are interested not in truth, but in power and in the maintenance of that power. To maintain that power, it is essential that people remain in ignorance, that they live in ignorance of the truth, even the truth of their own lives. What surrounds us, therefore, is a vast tapestry of lies upon which we feed.
The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power while masquerading as a force for universal good. It's a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. I put to you that the United States is without doubt the greatest show on the road. Brutal, indifferent, scornful, and ruthless it may be, but it is also very clever.
As a salesman, it is out on its own. And its most saleable commodity is self-love. It's a winner. Listen to all American presidents. It is time to pray and to defend the rights of the American people. And I ask the American people to trust their president in the action he's about to take on behalf of the American people. It's a scintillating strategy. Language is actually employed to keep thought at bay. The words, the American people, provide a truly voluptuous cushion of reassurance. You don't need to think. Just lie back on the cushion. The cushion may be suffocating your intelligence and your critical faculty, but it's very comfortable.
This does not apply, of course, to the 40 million people living below the poverty line and the 2 million men and women imprisoned in the vast gulag of prisons, which extends across the U.S.
The United States no longer bothers about low-intensity conflict. It no longer sees any point in being reticent or even devious. It puts its cards on the table without fear or favor. It quite simply doesn't give a damn about the United Nations, international law, or critical dissent, which it regards as impotent and irrelevant. The United States is now totally frank about putting its cards on the table. That is the case. Its official declared policy is now defined as full spectrum dominance. That is not my term. It is theirs. Full spectrum dominance means control of land, sea, air, and space, and all attendant resources. The United States now occupies 702 military installations throughout the world in 132 countries, with the honorable exception of Sweden. We don't quite know how they got there, but they're there all. The United States possesses 8,000 active and operational nuclear warheads. 2,000 are on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched with 15 minutes warning. It is developing new systems of nuclear force known as bunker busters. The possession and threatened use of nuclear weapons is at the heart of present American political philosophy. We must remind ourselves that the United States is on a permanent military footing and shows no sign of relaxing. many thousands, if not millions, of people in the United States itself are demonstrably sickened, shamed, and angered by their government's actions. But as things stand, they are not a coherent political force yet. But the anxiety, uncertainty, and fear, which we can see growing daily in the United States, is unlikely to diminish.
This has been your Thursday night New American Dream Winter Stock performance in the band shell in the city park. Excerpts from a speech given by Harold Pinter while accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature, 2005. The talk was entitled Art, Truth, and Politics. And thanks to the Knights of Columbus for the hand warmer holy cards. Much appreciated. Well, it has been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The American dream has dangled before our eyes for over 200 years. The American dream is the goal that we Americans hold on to when everything else is gone. The American dream is our ideal. Too bad it's just a dream. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns, while the world wails, fists clenched, eyes blazing, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia, while they sleep on through the alarm, the house of fire. We pick up our story after Michael M., staff member at Sun God Group Home, has sped off on his moped to tell the people at the workshop that there is a sit-down strike taking place in the Sun God driveway and that they will be a little late. On his way, he swerved to miss a little girl, jumped the curb, and rammed his blue flake helmet into a war memorial for World War II at the city park, breaking the war memorial. And now the National Guard and police have stormed the park and taken Michael M. away in a National Guard helicopter. Where did they take him? Let's find out, shall we? Well, but first, we take a peek at the activities of Mayor Dick Heavens.
My Heavens, or DH, or Dickless, what they call it. Dick was the mayor of Homeland. He headed down the west side of Main Street. He and his wife took up the whole walk, pushing a two-handled, six-passenger monostock stroller, bearing the six H children, each wearing a camo safety helmet as they headed to their daily dental appointment. Dick, not a tall man, wore a camouflage safety helmet as well, as did his wife. They each wore camo jogging shorts, t-shirt, tennis shoes, and socks. DH also sported a camo jockstrap with protective cuff, extra large, outsider's coat. He reached down to adjust it to keep the cuff from falling out. Man and wife made the sign of the cross and stopped to watch three F-16 fighter jets scream over downtown at rooftop level, headed for the west side. They waited and gazed into the distance until they heard the bombs hitting their target. "They're keeping us so free," Dick's wife Jane smiled. He nodded, and they continued on their walk. The electronic blinking sign at the bank showed 101 for the temperature. They stopped to peruse the front window display of the Sun God is So Awesome bookstore and saw 10 copies of their pastor's book, Oh God, in 10 wire rack displays. 100 additional copies lined the shelf down the north wall, and another 100 or more filled the south wall. There was another display of the same book running down the middle of the store. Dick and Jane moved off down the walk and stopped in front of the library. Dick ran a finger down the outside of the glass city announcement board to the band list. He silently read Air Guitar, Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Imagine, Daytime Lawn Watering, Harry Potter. He smiled to see air drums penciled in above air guitar. They passed six newspaper vending boxes. green, yellow, red, orange, gray, blue. Each contained the same newspaper, with its front page story detailing last night's mission on the west side of Homeland, the number of the enemy killed, the types of new weapons used. Dick halted when his wife stopped to answer her cell phone chime. Yes, oh yes. We'll have to do that. Yes, yes, yes. Oh, do. He had to yell that last do as another fighter group rolled up. Meanwhile, Dick had begun to visit with the bank vice president. One game at a time, said Dick. The man nodded. Take it to the next level. Again, the man nodded. On the same page. The man nodded yet more intently. Step up to the plate. The man nodded with his whole body. The man squeezed around the stroller, patting one of the kids on his helmet as Mrs. Heavens closed the pump. They pushed down the walk, heading toward a Mexican family. The father and mother each guided a child by the hand, and the father also carried a young one on his shoulder. The parents were young, barely into their 20s. Around their necks, each of the five carried an identification certificate in a wooden frame. The document had a gold American housekeeping seal of approval and a color photo of June Cleaver in her 1950s frilly kitchen apron, saying, Amelia Rodriguez is a human being. Each certificate had a 3-year expiration date. The mother pulled the rope wrapped around her bloody young hand. The other end of the rope was a child's wagon bearing a metal box that contained a dead boy, a rosary, and a stuffed teddy bear. The child they were required to sacrifice at the border crossing at El Paso in return for passage of the rest. Hello. Mrs. H stopped in her tracks and looked sternly into the eyes of the woman, who also stopped, showed the placard around her neck, smiled, curtsied, and said, hello, as was required. Oh no, Dee, the press. Mrs. H nodded at a group of men and women on their knees crawling up the walk, each one holding a writing pad and pen and gritting their teeth. Sweat poured down as they competed, trying to reach the H's first. As the news hounds got within 10 feet, the local barber rushed from his shop and stood with folded arms, not allowing the journalist any closer. A car squealed to a stop in the middle of Main Street and out jumped a young woman in business dress, who sprinted over to join the barber in blocking the walk. She stepped over a crying, naked, skinny, brown baby. It stopped for a moment, thinking it was going to be picked up, but then continued to screech. The woman joined the barber with arms crossed over her chest. Dick and Jane stopped and stood straight, smiling wide. One of the female reporters on her hands and knees crawled between the legs of the businesswoman to snap a photo of the first family and shout out her question. Another fighter group whooshed overhead. The reporters in the heavens froze until the rocket's red glare. Second place. Mayor Heavens, she shouted. American pie. Dick smirked and pointed at her with her face caught for a second in the undergarments of the businesswoman. How long will the ban on daytime lawn watering last? Dick put his thumb inside his forefinger and gestured. Soon, he said. He pointed at a mail reporter between the legs of the barber. Community college, what's on your mind? Yes, Mr. Mayor. The baby sucked air into its lungs and let out a desperate cry. You said you would address library fines, loose dogs, dandelions, and season pool pass prices. When will we hear something about those matters from your administration? Dick smiled, gestured with his thumb finger, and began to speak. The baby fell to its side and tried to call out. Spittle ran from its mouth. With a mighty effort, it rolled to its back, raised its arms for its mother, and let out a wail. It was drowned out by the roar and suck of an F-16 screaming over. The pilot gave a thumbs up as the baby's breath ceased. "Okay, thanks, see ya," said Jane. The reporters got off their stomachs, turned, and scribbled on their pads as they crawled away. The Dick and Jane family strolled along. They passed in front of the brick Homeland Jail. Lined up along both sides of the walk, sitting against the building and on the curb, were women and children with some men mixed in. Heads down, with eyes closed, sucking breath, their shoulders drooped as they sat smoking, crying, and moaning. Dick and Jane squeezed between them, forcing those against the wall to pull their legs to their chest. Inside the wall, as Dick passed on the left within 2 feet of the cell block, came the cries of those inside. Fingernails scraped on the concrete blocks as they tried to reach their children, whom they bounced on their knees the day before and whom they would not be able to hold again until those infants were young men and women. Many of the inmates were drug offenders. The war on drugs had been one of Dick's most successful programs. He and his advisors, notably his wife, had decided that drugs were ruining Homeland. Now almost all the drugs had been arrested and sentenced and sent away on long prison terms. Well then, next the first family stopped into the Homeland Dental Office. "Hi, Adara, Everett, 10th anniversary, congrats." The radio on low volume behind the counter said something about the number of dead in the west side in the past week. "Ford? Chevy? Red? Yellow?" Boom! Blood spattered over the front window as a policeman squashed someone's head. An assistant wheeled the Heavens children back for their checkup. Dick and Jane sat in one of the plastic primary colored chairs by the window, reading books about their family. The window shook as if they might shatter when a bomber roared overhead. "The kids?" one of the women behind the desk hollered over. "Busy?" Jane yelled back. "Great, great, great," said the person now invisible behind the high counter. "Always," shouted Jane. Blood, thick and maroon, ran under the front door, spreading across the room. Dick moved his feet back to avoid it getting on his shoes. The rendering truck roared by on the side street next to the office. The driver fought to obey the stop sign on the hill, tune her radio, and keep from rolling back. Couldn't see if anyone was behind her. A black baby body plopped off the side, hitting the pavement with a soft melon sub. Out the back end, a thin young naked woman and an old lady without shoes dropped, cracking their lifeless heads. The truck roared away, the driver pleased to have found a song she really liked. The Heavens children were pushed out by the dental assistant and hygienist. "See you tomorrow," the women smiled and waved. Dick and Jane stood. "See you at church. Bye-bye."
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There is no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing the United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial and put on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearing and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream. Not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now, we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That is someone's spin on the day's news. Somebody's advertising slogan, someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire. Those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attack. He is complicit. He has lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See, there's a plane there in that.